flight zone is for immediate...
Wait a minute. Have you heard?
This is a show to keep you on the edge of your seat.
Citizens of America,
welcome to the RadioCast.
Hello and welcome everybody to the RadioCast. My name is Joseph Taft. Today I am joined by fellow ECAT crewmates Ben Bradford and Jack Kelleher. We are here to discuss the 1952 feature film Fear and Desire, the official, maybe unofficial, directorial debut of the late, great Stanley Kubrick. The RadioCast is an Eastern Community Access television program that can be found wherever you get your podcasts. Make sure to rate and review the pod to let us know how you feel. But without further ado, I say we get into the making of this movie. Because, quite honestly, this is a film where some of the most interesting things do not happen on screen. It's a film where the making of and the post-release of it and the public domain run are some of the most interesting things. So I want to get into it a little bit. Just say hello, though. Didn't give you a chance to see how you guys are doing today. On this wonderful Friday.
Well, thank you, Joe. I'm doing great. I'm hyped up on Kubrick for the first time in a while. Not really. I think the last time I watched one of his movies was like a month ago. I rewatched Barry Lyndon.
Okay, yeah.
But I'm excited to. I wouldn't call this a good movie, but I think it's we can talk. It's going to be an interesting podcast. We're going to talk about a lot of good movies and also the feature of the day.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Definitely an interesting movie to talk about, especially if you're a fan of Kubrick.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, I've only seen, I'm going to start to get this right off the jump. I've only seen The Shining and this. So I am a Kubrick newcomer. I was going to say a different word, but newcomer. And I know you guys have seen more, so we can definitely go to y'all for a little bit of backstory. And well, I guess it wouldn't be backstory because this movie's the backstory, I guess you would say.
This is the story of how Stanley Kubrick became a filmmaker. He made a movie and learned by doing it wrong.
Yeah.
So absolutely. He could do it more right than anyone had before in the future.
So kind of I was reading about a production like backstory of this film. So before this, Kubrick was a photographer, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I forget what magazine was.
Look magazine.
Yeah, Look magazine. And he actually quit that so he could make this movie. And it definitely shows he's a photographer, because the cinematography of this film, even though it was a definitely low budget, I did find the cinematography, but I could not say that word.
It's a tough one.
It is.
Yeah. I found the camera work to be very good, and that's something that Kubrick later in his career is kind of well renowned for, is like his use of framing and camera work. Mm-hmm. That's something that in almost every one of his films you'll see a creative and like cool camera work. And so you can kind of see the seeds of that starting to form in this film. And I was reading that, speaking of the camera work, that anytime in the movie there was a panning shot, they did not have the budget for like a rig. So what they would do is Kubrick would put the camera in a baby carriage, and then they just push the baby carriage, and that's how they would get panning shots.
Wow, that's jerry-rigged at its finest. That's amazing.
Yeah. And he made this movie with 15 people.
15.
And those include, it was a crew of 15, and those included the actors.
And three Mexican, Mexicans who did not speak English who were helping him move the gear. So it was,
I didn't know that, though.
Yeah, it's, so he, the version I watched was on YouTube, and it included an interview. Because Kubrick gave very few interviews, I think that is kind of why he is as renowned as he is. Not just his movies, but the fact that he never talked about them. He didn't do interviews. Most quotes from him come from other people's interviews, and they said, yeah, Stanley Kubrick said this to me. So it's all secondhand, most everything. But this was one of the few interviews he gave. I think it was from the mid-60s, and he was talking about this movie, and he basically said he hated it.
Yeah, he had nothing but bad things to say.
No, he... As a matter of fact, in the 90s, when this goes in the public domain, he was begging people publicly, please don't show people this movie because it's not good. And he said in the interview, he was the director, the cinematographer, the camera assistant, he loaded the film and he lit it. So he was doing everything camera related, and it should be noted this movie was not recorded with sound. So he was doing he was the whole crew basically for his own movie.
Yeah, I read that it was he filmed it silent with no audio, and then the actors would later come in and dub over their lines, which I read added about $20,000 to the budget. Which I cannot find a direct answer on like what exactly the budget was. It's kind of disputed.
He said 10K in the interview I watched. He said production budget was 10K, so that's the equivalent of $100,000 today. Which
do you think that he included the post-production stuff like sound?
No, he just said production budget. He went in with $10,000 to shoot it.
Okay.
So that was that was really just cost of film and cost of like labor.
That's probably why when you see the range in which people talk about, oh, it was probably like 10 to 50, it starts at 10 because that's what he said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then it's like, oh, how much did it cost to, because I heard, you know, that brought the budget up quite a bit.
You can imagine, because I mean, you had to, at the time, you rented a sound booth, you had to have the tape, you had to.
Yeah, there's a lot of elements that went into it back then that aren't the case now, but it's still like very, very time consuming, I would assume. To run back to Look Photography, that was the name of it?
That was a magazine, yes.
Yeah, Look Magazine, and he was a photographer there. He took a pretty iconic photograph at the age of 16 in order to get that job that he then quit at 23, 24.
Mm-hmm.
It was a picture of a man at a newspaper stand mourning the death of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've ever seen this picture. We can throw it up on screen right now. It's a pretty crazy picture. It has a lot of emotion. The guy sitting at the stand, you can tell like he's very distraught over this, and it's pretty funny how he was immediately given a job after taking that picture, and then he goes on to make two shorts that are almost documentary style.
Yeah, and now have either of you seen the shorts?
I have yet to. I am a sleeping giant.
I've heard of them, but I have not seen them. I'm aware of their existence.
I've only seen the boxing one. I haven't seen, what is it, the Flying Padre?
The fighting, the boxing one is called The Day of the Fight, and Flying Padre is about, it is a priest in New Mexico.
He's delivering supplies by plane, I believe.
Yeah. That's
the plot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one, but I've seen Day of the Fight, and it's very good. It's really well shot. It's lit fantastically, and that's part of the reason why he shot this movie the way he did, because for documentaries at the time, you know, the sound gear, movable sound gear, that was more late 50s, early 60s that started to be introduced. That's part of why you have like the French New Wave at the time. You had more movable cameras, more portable and portable sound gear, so you could do that kind of stuff. But so like most documentaries for like news and stuff, you just add it all in post.
That's right.
Yeah. You know, you'd Foley it, and then you have, that's why all the documentaries at the time are so heavy on the voiceover and stuff, because it was like easier to just do voiceover than like dub for a documentary. So he was kind of applying what he knew, his photography, his documentary making, to this film.
Yeah, and you can definitely tell, because the movie has a lot, it begins with an opening narration, and then throughout the movie you hear something that Kubrick never, he would only do, I think, at least from the films I've seen of him, one other time, is like going inside the characters' minds and hearing their internal thoughts. So there's like a lot of narrating and eternal thoughts and dubbed over thing. And you know, the only other movie, at least of his that I've seen, that does that is A Clockwork Orange, where you hear Alex DeLarge's inner thoughts. So you can definitely see like what he learned in documentary with like the voiceover narrations still carrying over to this movie. And even like the opening narration kind of has very much like a documentary narration style to it, because the film is a war movie, but it's incredibly vague on what exactly the war is. It came out 1952, which was 1 year before the Korean War ended, so you can kind of make parallels to that, but the uniforms kind of look like World War II uniforms, so
yes, I thought so.
Well, it's probably because of the budget. They couldn't really make it about a specific war. And they filmed it in the hills of California, so they couldn't really say it's in, like, Africa or Asia or in Europe.
Or that it was, like, too close to any other war that had preceded it, you know? Yeah. Like, I think, like you said, the uniforms do kind of give the vibe of World War II. I thought I might have missed it. I thought there was a moment in the film where someone said the Reich, but I could be wrong. I don't think so. I probably did, because then when I read all about it, you know, they're saying that he kept it broad, which makes sense because he was trying to tell a world spanning story, like something that everyone can relate to and not be have it be lost in specificity. There's not very many things you could say that. But if you were too specific and you made it about a specific war, then the message would then be kind of muddled and wouldn't hit. And I think, honestly, even though, I mean, Kubrick has done nothing but talk negatively about this film, whether it's from his mouth or someone else's. But, I mean, let's be honest. Like, if anybody else made that movie in the 50s, like, I don't think that they would talk so negatively about it. I mean... Is it great? No, by any means. But like, not by any means. But at the same time, I feel like it hits on a few elements. We'll get into the actual film shortly, but in a few spots, I think there are great, strong moments where you can see his signature style popping out. I wanted to ask about those shorts as well. Were those silent?
Those, no, but the sound was recorded in post.
Similarly to this?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and then... So I kind of wanted to go off one of your points and talk about Kubrick's other war films. I know you haven't seen them, but he has two.
Yeah.
Well, I guess technically three. I guess Dr. Strangelove kind of is two.
Yeah. I was thinking that too. Like, does Strangelove count as an anti-war film? Because
I mean, it considering the ending.
Yeah.
I would call that anti-war, but all three of those, and I guess Barry Lyndon has war elements, but that's not important. All three of those. Paths of Glory, Doctor Strangelove, and Full Metal Jacket. Mm-hmm. All those are very specific, and I feel like they do what this movie tries to do a lot better. And I think that's his development as a filmmaker, obviously. Yeah, but
most definitely.
Yeah,
what's interesting is two of those actually have a similar element to this, which is the woman character. Both those movies have a similar thing. So do we want to talk about the woman now and that kind of role in the movie?
I think we can get into that a little later. I'd like to talk about the movie kind of chronologically, talk about it in order, so we're not jumping around too much and getting lost. But yeah, I have heard that in those other war movies that he's gone, there are some similar tropes that happen that I think he is refining. This guy is known as a perfectionist, so it makes sense that he would go back and be like, well, let me do this a little bit better, or like a little bit, or you know, a lot better.
Yeah, there's a lot of moments and themes in this movie that definitely pop up in all of his other films, so you can kind of see like where he started, and then like where you can kind of see like the seeds that would later grow into his later movies.
That's right, absolutely. That's a very good way of putting it, the seeds. Yeah, and like, I mean, just the fact that it was almost a student film. I mean, 15 people, the fact that the budget obviously was higher, but it's been disputed how he got his hands on that money. There was rumor that he had a family member that was wealthy and that they owned like a drugstore and they helped fund it.
That's what I heard.
Yeah, but then there was also rumor that his family took out like life insurance and paid for it with that. So I think it's because he never talked about it. He tried to keep it suppressed that everyone else was like, well, I heard it was this. I actually heard it was this. And then Kubrick sitting there actually knowing the answer was just like, yeah, I'm not going to say anything about this because
he was probably working on Napoleon.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. He was too busy. He said, look, that movie was crap, but this Napoleon thing is going to be awesome. And also, I mean, the fact that this movie came out in 1952 and Paths of Glory was 5 years later. I mean, it's really not that long.
And Paths of Glory is, I mean, I agree with you, it's ahead of its time. Like, when you look at it, it's almost like, for a 60s movie, this is fine. This came out in 1952. It's like,
exactly.
All right, I can see this is sloppy. This is, like, not well put together, but, like, this is ahead of its time in a way, but yeah, Paths of Glory is like one of the best like movies of that period. It's so well done and amazing. And a lot of it is pretty like, you know, minor people talking in rooms, and he just makes it feel so big. Yeah. And there's a lot of similar elements that carry over that you can tell, like the men, it's World War One, so the men are behind enemy lines, and that sequence is like basically this movie compressed into like 20 minutes and it's just a part of a bigger story, and it works way better in that. He also, I think the biggest problem with this movie, and Kubrick admitted it, and the actors in this movie have been directed, have talked about it. He didn't direct them.
Just at all?
No, he didn't tell them how to act. He was too busy making the movie. Yeah. So they just, and I think that's a big problem you have with the movie, is they're all acting completely differently. They're all giving performances in basically different movies. Yeah. And I feel like that is something we can talk about.
That kind of makes sense. But my biggest issue with the movie was the, at least in my mind, was the script, the story, which the premise of the film is very simple. It's about four soldiers who are stuck behind enemy lines and them just trying to find a way back and encountering all these obstacles.
And failing.
Most of them failing. Yeah, like, so do you want to get into, almost 17 minutes in? Let's talk about the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. We can talk about the plot and stuff, because, I mean, it starts out pretty, it is funny how it is similar to some of his other films, and I just want to say, like, it would make sense that the man, I mean, he's a master filmmaker, like, it makes sense that, you know, he does it again 5 years later and he like does it better. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like he got a crack at it beforehand to then make a movie that you consider is one of the best movies of that generation, that era of that time. So it's very interesting. It's like, well, it took him messing it up pretty bad the first, but from his standards, you know. But yeah, we definitely talk about the film. I mean, it starts out with those big, even though it's 4:3, you can tell these big wide landscape shots of the woods, and this voiceover by David Allen is our narrator, who is actually not the lieutenant. I thought the entire movie that the lieutenant was the narrator. That was not true. I think this is a common mistake that people make, but they do sound similar, and it comes from, it almost gives the lieutenant is the main character. I don't know if you could say that any of them truly are, but I feel like he is the one, he's the more like, he just felt to me throughout it that he was going to survive and that he was being portrayed as this more, I don't want to say macho, but
he's in charge,
experienced soldier who is in charge, but also there's this element of he's been here before. Sydney, played by Paul Mazursky, is like, you know, so yellow, you know, he's so young and like and naive, and so I mean that ends up being his demise. But the movie gets going and immediately just, it kind of lays the plot on you via exposition, which maybe not the strongest thing in the world, but it gets you up to speed. You know, they pretty much just lay out verbally what's going on. Okay, here we are, 6 miles out. Our plane, that was a bummer how our plane crashed. And we landed 6 miles out of, you know, it's like, it's very funny because it is exposition at its finest, but I mean, it is what it is.
Did it feel like the movie should have had like a first act that led to that? And then instead they just kind of, like, you kind of meet these characters and then they get in the plane, then it crap. Like, it feels like,
I get what you mean. Yeah, it's almost like we pop into the middle of the story a little bit.
Yeah, and I never felt like you, I feel like structure is this movie's, one of its biggest failings. It kind of, things just kind of happen. And then
at the wall,
the climax sort of works. I think the film's finale is one of the better parts of it, but I feel like a lot of it is just
things happening.
This happens. Now this happens.
Yeah, yeah. 100%. It's like, you know, like I said, things are thrown at the wall. I think that character-wise, I don't want to get too far in the movie, but I think that character-wise, some of the arcs work.
Mm-hmm.
And that by the climax, that's why some of the climax works, I think, because we've been with these characters for an hour and like we've seen how they've changed. So it works in that regard. But yeah, like you said, you know, you had issues with the script and like the plot. Personally, I mean, I like the idea of it. I like the idea of the concept, right? I mean, that's why he used it in all his other movies, apparently, that they are in behind, not all movies, that they're behind enemy lines. And like, you know what? We're going to make this raft and we're going to go up the river at night. I'm like, okay, that's a pretty good idea. You know, seems pretty all right. But then the way things just deteriorate more and more to the point of yeah, this isn't going to happen. This raft is now going to be like our failsafe, or like our distraction method by the end. And it's pretty interesting how that ends up being the case.
Yeah, that's something I kind of found a little funny, is that they're making this raft for four grown men to get on, and that raft looked like it could barely fit two of them. And at the end, we see there's two of them on the raft, and both of them just barely fit on that thing. I was like, how is that supposed to fit four people?
Yeah, maybe if they were laying on top of each other, but I highly doubt that that was going to happen. Yeah, it's a very good question. It looked like by the end of the movie, when Sydney is climbing up onto the raft, it's like the other guy, Mac, almost falls off the raft because the weight almost takes him off. It's like he almost teetered him over.
It's like the door from Titanic.
I feel like it settles that debate. No, it couldn't fit both of them.
Literally, yeah, it could. Yep. I know.
Yeah, so they try and build a raft to go down the river, but a enemy spy plane then kind of flies overhead, and that scares them off. They run into the woods where they then... I kind of forget, is it after that when they encounter the cabin full of enemy soldiers?
Yes.
And let's talk about that scene. I thought that was one of the better scenes in the movie, just kind of because of the editing. And
it was the one moment where the style the movie's going for works.
I think. Let's talk about the editing. The editing of this movie was kind of unlike any Kubrick film I'd seen before, because I can't really think... his films never really, in my mind, employed because the editing was kind of very hectic, very like a lot of quick cuts back and forth between
chaotic
people, very chaotic. And I kind of associate Kubrick with more like these long shots that just kind of hold on subjects.
I mean, Clockwork is the exception, but I think, one thing I think that's really interesting about Kubrick, most directors have a very consistent style. I feel like Kubrick doesn't. There's certain things you can point out, but his movies have a tendency to feel very, very different. So I'd say a majority of his movies don't have very quick cutting, but like Clockwork Orange definitely employs a lot of that.
Oh yeah, like Clockwork and The Shining also does, when it will like cut to like things like the bloody elevator and like ghosts.
The girls in the hallway.
Yeah, but it uses that kind of sparingly in those movies, when it's like every scene there's like frantic cutting in.
It takes away from it.
It got a little distracting after a while. But I did think when because they find this cabin where these enemy soldiers are inside, and they bust in and they kill them. And that's the scene I felt the frantic editing worked the most, because it was just like all these quick cuts of them like stabbing and beating, just shooting these people.
Yeah. And do they even shoot them? I think they like just physically are like stabbing and like beating them.
They stab them, but then another enemy soldier comes in carrying a box, and they just gun him down. And everyone just guns him down.
Yeah, I completely forgot about that.
Like, the editing of this movie kind of reminded me a bit of like Eisenstein and like Battleship of Potemkin, which I was trying to look up if that was intentional, it's kind of interesting, like what I then came across Kubrick's opinion of Eisenstein. Kubrick did not like Eisenstein.
Really? I heard the opposite.
He liked his editing style. Mm-hmm. He liked Battleship of Potemkin's, like the editing and the camera work. He thought the story and acting in Eisenstein's films were crap.
He's kind of right.
Yeah.
And I love Eisenstein. He was a big Podovkin fan, who was another Soviet film theorist. He apparently read Podovkin's book dozens of times, like in preparation for this movie, just reading.
Interesting.
Yeah, I read that he liked him more than he liked Eisenstein.
I would also agree that Podovkin's kind of underrated, and he kind of invented the montage.
Yeah.
He is the theorist of the montage, and really put that in. It's worth reading some of his stuff if you're interested in editing. Well, that's my camera. It's definitely, if you're interested in editing, that's one of the three books I think you should really read, because his theories are used today by most editors. They're just ingrained in our subconscious now, but like someone had to come up with it at some point.
And kind of this cabin scene is when we start to see some of like some of the characters start to deteriorate a little, because Sydney, the young guy, is just staring at these dead bodies. He's like lying like cheek down on the floor, staring at this dead man's face. And later on in the movie, his character's going to go off the deep end, so it kind of starts to lay the groundwork for that here.
Yes, that was a very important scene, because if you Well, one, I thought that was honestly probably my favorite scene in the movie. This is the first time that they go in and they have to silently, not, I mean, they don't really do it too silently, kill these two, eventually three soldiers. I thought it felt like the whole film was edited around that sequence.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the way we just talked about it, like with The Shining, it's used sparingly. I feel like he may have realized that, oh, like it's better to maybe have that sequence be crazy, but then counterbalance it with less craziness so that when it does happen, you're like, wow, that was insane. If you imagine how the movie could have been without all that crazy cutting, and then you get to that sequence and it is the way it is, mm-hmm. Maybe it would have been more effective as an entire film.
Yeah, well, I think it's out of necessity. I think like a lot of those scenes, you notice he's using the same shot like and then cutting it up because he did not shoot enough footage, which like, he never shot a movie like this before. He didn't know like how much coverage he needs, and I think that's also apparent. It works in this scene, but the 180 line, maybe let's explain the 180 line. I think one of you two should explain that, because I'm bad at explaining it. I just know it when I see it. Yeah,
so it's like, all right, I guess I'll set it up right here. All right, if my film professor watches this, I'm sorry, because I'm going to butcher this.
that's why I'm not.
If I am subject.
Well, remember, some people are going to be listening to this podcast only, so they won't be able to see.
They're going to be listening, so I can't even visually explain it.
180 line is kind of like, imagine in front of you there's like a 180 degrees, like 90 degrees in front of you. And usually to keep camera work consistent, like whenever it's focusing on a subject, when the camera cuts to a different angle, it has to be within 180 degrees of where that subject is facing, like to kind of keep consistency. That's probably not a great explanation, but
you're close.
Like this film breaks that rule all the time. It'll be like someone's face, then it'll be like a wide shot of the whole group, then like a shot of just a random woods, then back to that person's face,
someone else's face.
Yeah. So
in the wide shot, they're facing right, and then their close up, they're facing left, but it's the same side of their face, and it's like
there's no consistency. He just wasn't paying attention to it. You know what I mean? Yeah. I think he was just
with photography. It doesn't matter. There's no 180 line because all the pictures are their own thing.
Yeah,
he didn't get it.
And it's kind of funny on their own. Yes,
and it's kind of funny you mentioned that Kubrick didn't film enough shots for this movie. Where if you know anything about the production of any of his other movies, he would go overboard with filming so many shots for movies. Because was it Eyes Wide Shut? How many times did he make Tom Cruise walk through that doorway?
87.
Yeah, and then in The Shining,
Adam would know.
Then The Shining, he made Shelley Duvall do that staircase scene over 100 times. And by the end, so like in the movie, her character is like crying and like haggard. Shelley Duvall was literally crying because she was just so exhausted.
Yeah. Well, I think it was more about performance than coverage when he did that later on. Like, the whole thing with Eyes Wide Shut is Tom Cruise is basically a robot. He's like a soulless human being within the movie.
Yeah.
And he was trying to get that performance out of him, so he made him do it 70 times. So, like, he literally drained the life out of him to get the performance he wanted.
Amen.
Which is a contrast to this movie where he kind of just let them do whatever. But
didn't really direct them.
I think the scene where the 180 line rule is the worst is with the woman. So that's kind of the next part after the cabin. So do we want
to? I'll set that up. So basically, they are they're building the raft when the woman comes along, this peasant girl, as she's referred to, and she comes up and they hide. She's looking around in the bushes, and it's pretty nice little sequence as she's coming up and looking for them. Obviously, we see him clear as day. I'm like, how do you not see the guy?
The angles make it work, but it's like when you see the wide of the scene, it's like, there's no way.
And she does see him until, you know, she does see him at the very end. And overall, it's like, it's a jumpy sequence. The cuts, it's kind of all like, it's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. That's kind of the whole movie. But they decide that, is it because of the spy plane? They decide that, we should probably go and were going to go and check. They were going to go and check something, and they decided to leave Sydney, Private Sydney, with
They were covering up the raft, right?
So they capture this peasant girl, and then kind of a debate of like, wait, what do we do with her? And this is kind of a scene that we'll see in a lot of future war movies, is the team capturing a civilian and then being like, crap, what do we do? If we let them go, they might go tell the enemy where we are. So that's something that will pop up in a lot of other future war movies. So that's kind of Kubrick breaking new ground. Well, it probably happened in movies before this, but they go back to check on the raft because they're worried enemy soldiers might have found it. So they leave Sydney, the young soldier, with the girl. And when I was watching the movie first time, I thought that made the most sense, because when they catch the girl, Sydney seems to be the most concerned for her. He's telling the old soldiers not to be rough with her to not hurt her.
The captain's being creepy in that scene.
The lieutenant becomes the lieutenant says a lot of weird lines to her.
Nowhere. And it goes nowhere. They just drop it after that one scene.
Yeah. And then kind of speaking of nowhere, as soon as the soldiers leave Sydney, who definitely seemed like he was the most concerned about the girl, he goes from 0 to 100 immediately. He goes he goes completely insane.
He goes Colonel Kurtz in like 5 minutes.
This is something that, again, Kubrick will do in many of his other movies, is featuring people deteriorating and like going insane. We see it in Full Metal Jacket. Mm-hmm. We see it in The Shining. We see it in sort of Clockwork Orange.
It's like the reverse. Yeah, it's so weird.
I know, sort of. Orange. And even then, we see something that people call the Kubrick stare. This is like, if you've...
Everyone do their camera.
Oh, yeah. For those who don't know, the Kubrick stare is what people refer to, a shot where a person will be staring right at the camera with this deranged look in their eyes, and their head is kind of slightly tilted forward. You see it in The Shining, Full Metal Jacket, A Clockwork Orange. Anytime in a Kubrick movie there's someone who's insane, they do the Kubrick stare. And Sydney does it in this whole sequence of him going insane. So that's the first time Kubrick did the Kubrick stare.
That's actually awesome that it did make an appearance, and then it ended up just becoming iconic. And I wonder if it was... if it was his idea or if it was Paul Mazursky's idea.
Well, like, he had to frame the shot like that. So.
Yeah, for sure. But if he wasn't directing like as much, I mean, he had to at least direct him enough to be like, hey, stay in the frame, buddy.
I think he said like, hey, do this. But he wasn't like talking about motivation or like the things you actually talk about with an actor.
Gotcha.
A movie.
Yeah. So as I was saying, Kubrick is in future films will betray people and even soldiers going insane. And kind of like with most things in this movie, he'll take that concept and do it a lot better in other movies, where in those films would be more of a slow progression, when this is kind of like a Sydney goes from, like, as I said, 0 to 100 immediately.
Yeah, real quick.
I was watching it and I was starting to kind of zone out. My cat was like doing something, so I turned around and I turned back, and he's like doing the crazy eyes the whole time, and I'm like, did I miss, like, rewound it, and I'm like, no, he just starts doing that. He just, because they have the flashes to like the scene that's like 10 minutes earlier in the movie when they're the porridge like spilling or the stew, that shot plays like 7 times in that sequence.
Just starts like singing and ranting about a magician, and I read he was like quoting lines from Shakespeare's play The Tempest.
Prospero is the main character in The Tempest,
which
I didn't know that.
So he goes insane and like starts acting very creepy to the girl, thinking that she's like being affectionate to him. He like wants to hug her, and it gets, and this I did like this, even though his insanity is a bit out of nowhere, this was a very tense scene. I'm just like what is he gonna do?
I thought her performance was really good, of her like she's doing a good job acting as someone who's like pretending to be okay with this when she's very clearly not. Like, I liked her performance in that scene a lot.
Virginia Leith, the actress who would then go on to be in the film The Brain That Wouldn't Die, another public domain film that we may cover on this program. Jack, you saw that movie on
Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Thank you. That must be a good one then.
It's definitely a B movie.
Banger film. Yeah. Virginia Leith, though, like, I love that during that performance, like, you can tell that she just has to get untied. You know what I mean? And then she's going to run. Like, you can tell. But it also goes into, like, Paul Mazursky, I think there are elements of it that are goofy, but I think that's because he didn't have, like you said, like, Stanley giving him an entire backstory to really, like, somewhere to go during, like, you know, somewhere during the scene, instead of kind of just letting it fly. I think it's, like, for me, it's, like, 90% unsettling and, like, 10% goofy. But it's enough where it does work, and I think that her, Virginia Leith's performance as well, gives another element where you can tell that she has goals within the scene, and it's, like, I think that is strong.
Yeah, she is one of the stronger... I don't think he's, like, a bad actor or anything, but I didn't think his performance was too good.
Yeah, I guess...
I thought it was really funny when he was... Because you said how the actors in the movie... Everybody in the movie feels like they're playing in a different movie.
Mm-hmm.
I love when he starts to mock
the lieutenant.
The lieutenant... to her,
yes.
And he starts doing, like, his voice, and the movie's in the 50s, but, like, a classic, like, 50s voice, like how a dude on Mr. Ed would, like, walk up and just start talking.
Yeah,
you know, like that classic.
And it doesn't even
TV
sound movie. Anything like the lieutenant.
No, it doesn't.
No, which is, I think, works. I think that's intentional, but it's like Max dude. Performance reminds me of have you guys ever seen the movie The Tin Helmet? It's the Sam Fuller movie. One of the few Korean War movies. It's very good.
Okay.
But he's an interesting director. I think some of his movies are in the public domain.
Yeah.
But he was a World War II veteran. He has a movie that's actually kind of similar to this, Men Behind Enemy Lines. They take a civilian, but it's done so much better.
I have to say, though, about the scene with the girl, before I forget, necessary. Totally necessary, and you know why?
Why?
Via the title standards, there's got to be some desire.
Fear and desire.
Well, right? That was like the third title this movie had, right?
That's true. Right? Yeah, get into that a little bit.
Don't remember. Oh, does someone with notes have?
Okay, yeah.
No, I didn't take any notes about that.
I just read this. When it premiered at the Venice Film Festival, it went by a different name, and I'll pull that up right now.
I think it also had fear in the title.
No, it was, I think it was like, I don't want to go too long without having it.
Okay,
yeah,
but
look it up right now, you guys.
I think the scene, when I was talking about the jump cutting stuff, the scene when she gets shot is, I think, the worst example of it. Because that's a scene where I feel like jumpy cutting could really work, like, emotionally.
Agreed.
But the part when she actually gets shot, the 180 line, her head... flips, like her whole body flips over like six times in a row between the close-up and the wide shot, and they're using the same shot over and over again. It's like
her body positioning is not consistent in the different shots. So Sydney eventually unties her because he thinks she's wants to hug him, and then she immediately bolts forward, and then he shoots her
because, I mean, like we said, the prisoner's dilemma, we didn't know, well, not really the prisoner's dilemma, but they didn't know if the prisoner was gonna go and tell. So see you later.
And then when Mac, the other soldier, comes back, sees what happens, Sydney says, "The magician did it."
Yeah, that was wild. What was going on there?
And then he just kind of runs off like a Looney Tunes character.
His arms are doing like this.
He blamed it on Shakespeare.
Oh, my God. It's something.
The original title when it was premiered was Shape of Fear.
Shape of Fear. And then I think the script had a different title.
Really?
So I think they shot it under a title, then changed it to Shape of Fear, and then did Fear and Desire after that. So it went through three iterations.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. The scene when she's shot should be the emotional peak of the movie. And I feel like it just kind of falls completely flat.
Yeah, that was a bummer. I mean, I was like, oh, man, that was it? I mean, it happened. It was what it was. He shot her, but it wasn't executed. It was not executed to the point of precision like this man is known for doing with most of his peak emotional moments in films.
The scene does a good job kind of building empathy for her. And then the actual escape and shooting is so poorly executed that it's just like kind of kills any emotional momentum you have, because this should be like
Yeah.
A really traumatic scene for the audience. Like, this poor woman was just getting fish, and then she gets kidnapped and then murdered by these soldiers.
Do you think it has to, real quick, do you think it has anything to do with us watching it in 2023? Or, I mean, you know, 5 years, like we said, 5 years later, he made
Paths of Glory.
Thank you. And there goes my cup. Oh, and it landed straight up. That's good.
Beautiful.
But no, he made that 5 years later. But is like, does that sequence being jerky, is that because it's not because of the time? It's because just the movie. I mean,
yeah, I think it's because of the movie. I think it's he was a first time filmmaker, and he was swinging for the fences, and he just kind of hit a foul ball.
He has some misses.
True that. And it's funny too, because I mean, I think cinema, if you look at, you know, one shot, I feel like this movie almost is like almost could be argued as every frame a painting, because I feel like every frame of the movie is beautiful. It's just like the one before it doesn't flow well into this one.
Yeah, and every it doesn't shot flow looks well good. Into
the next one. It's funny. It's which, like every shot does look really strong.
Yeah, which I mean, it looks great. It reminds me in appearance a lot of Rashomon, which I didn't see anything about influence, but you said you saw some sort of video where they were talking about Rashomon being an influence. I wasn't sure if it was intentional or if it was just they both shot in like semi-tropical forests, so like with natural light, so like you're gonna shoot that a certain way in terms of exposure and stuff. For sure. I feel like it looks great. The cinematography, by far the best part of the movie.
Yeah, I can agree with that statement.
And I feel like, I don't know, you've shot on film, Jack. Have you, Joe?
Yeah.
Not in my life, no.
Yeah, shooting on film,
it's not easy.
No, I mean, especially with a one-man crew, because you're like, you know, you have to meter everything. You have to load in complete darkness. Like, doing that as one person, not even team, it's like, I couldn't imagine doing that. And I was doing 16 millimeter, which is easy. Yeah, we both did Bolex, right?
Yeah, it's a Bolex camera.
Yeah, you're loading, like, you know, these big reels and then loading the reels on. Like, that's tough for, like, a team of people. For one guy who'd, like, probably never done 35 like that before. It's like, that is impressive that, like, none of the shots are, like, blown out or out of focus. Like, every image looks pretty. I think it's a little bit bland somewhat, some of the cinematography. It's not as visually exciting as later period, but like considering the budget, considering limitations, it's fantastic cinematography wise.
There probably was bad footage that was like blown out and overexposed, but he probably just cut it out of the movie.
Likely. But for the final product to come out and have it be as clean, I mean, obviously not clean in terms of 180 and keeping, you know, sides of the camera right and which direction people are looking, like that is all over the place. And like you said, I think it would be funny if that was the reason why, other than for performances, that's the reason why he like is known for doing all these takes. Is because for Fear and Desire he just did not do enough and was like, that's never gonna happen again.
It was kind of trial and error for him with this movie.
He probably like was on set and he was like, I need the shot, and he got the shot and he's like, that's good, and then he got to the editing room and it's like, oh no. I needed more than that.
What have I done?
Yeah, so kind of getting back to the movie story, after the girl dies, the remaining three soldiers, Mac, Lieutenant Corby and Private Fletcher.
I could not remember his name. I remember Lieutenant Matt.
Fletcher was definitely the most boring character in the movie. He just kind of stood there the whole time.
Wasn't there a fifth guy at the beginning who died?
I don't think so.
Couldn't remember.
I thought it was just the four. I think you might just be thinking of the fact that there were double actors throughout this movie that were getting confusing.
Yeah, and kind of getting to that. So the three of them then go back to do the raft plan, but Mac throughout the movie, so from where they have the raft kind of across the river, there's like this enemy base, and kind of for budget reasons it's not a very impressive looking enemy base.
Someone's house.
Well, there's this enemy general who Mac becomes obsessed with, and throughout the movie he keeps talking about killing this general. And eventually, as they're getting ready, they kind of change the plan so that Mac will go on the raft and like cause a distraction. Corby and Fletcher will go into the base, kill the general, and then escape in a plane. And this is kind of the part of the movie that started to drag for me the most, because There was a lot of moments of just Mac on the raft going down the river, just internal like monologuing over and over and over, and it just went
like
on
10
for
10 minutes. It's just like him on the raft.
It's just 10 minutes, just him like Tom Sawyering down the river, just like, having eternal monologues. Which, well, kind of like, this part of the film is what kind of gives is where we kind of get the fear of the title is.
Yeah.
Because Mac has a line that, if I can find it, it's, yeah, he says, I'm 34 years old and I've never done anything important.
Yeah.
And that's sort of his motivation for wanting to kill this general, is that he wants to do something big. He wants to like kill an enemy general, which will have like an impact on the war.
That's right. And his life.
Yeah. And And the general kind of becomes his white whale. Like, he just wants to do this one thing so that people will remember him, because he's scared that, like, he'll never get anything done in his life.
He's doing it for the glory.
Yeah, and we get, and his inner monologues, we kind of get it through that, but it kind of gets a bit repetitive after a while.
He says it like six times. And I feel like that was the biggest part to me, that was like, where's the first act setting up his character that pays off at the end, because the whole climax is built off
that. Like, it's like part of that sequence was to make us care more. It's like, we should care, we should be fully invested by the point that he gets on that raft and starts riding it out. But I have to say too, like, I'll explain that after, but wild sequence. Here it is. I was just like, why, if maybe if there were just less words, maybe just don't have just him voicing the entire time. Trim it a touch, but like, it's moments of him riding it. Yeah, right. Moments of him, you know, Tom Sawyering it down with no talking, and then just a little bit might have been more effective. I don't know though. Like, I'm not here to, you know.
Yeah, I think I mentioned earlier is Kubrick in his films would rarely use like voiceover narration. That's something he would not use a whole lot in some of his other movies. And I usually associate Kubrick with as a filmmaker who shows instead of tells, mostly with like The Shining and 2001 A Space Odyssey. There's a lot of showing, not telling, and letting people figure out on themselves what's going on. And in this film, there was a lot of telling. A
whole lot of exposition.
So I definitely can see how maybe he looked at this film and was like, I'm not going to do that again.
Yeah, for sure.
Barry Lyndon has a narrator, but it's kind of like an omniscient kind of narrator.
Yeah.
It's like narrating a book. But what makes that interesting is like, a lot of what he says is different than what we're seeing on screen. So it's almost like creating this disconnect. Like,
gotcha.
Who is this narrator? What is this story? Where are we hearing it? You know, he's doing it in a very different way, but
it's guided. Where with this, it's more like,
I need something to tell the story. I didn't shoot enough footage, and now I'm in the editing room trying to figure this out.
Because we can't get Kenny back to do the voiceover, so, you know, we'll just ask Dave.
Speaking of monologuing, we finally kind of meet the general, who's played by the same actor who plays Lieutenant Corby, and
the most confusing thing in the movie.
Yeah, and he also has a lot of monologuing going on, sitting in his office with his captain, who's played by the same actor who plays Fletcher. And you
I'm so confused at this point. And I'm like, what are they doing here? But go ahead.
Symbolism.
Well,
which I can explain.
It's I think it's one of those examples of unintentional symbolism where he had actors play multiple roles purely because there's only five actors in this movie. So they had them redo it out of necessity, but it kind of does unintentionally become a metaphor of like, it's kind of like them killing themselves essentially. Like a commentary on like war and like how the enemy is not as different as you think. Cause throughout the movie, throughout the movie, Mac, as he's thinking about this general, thinks of him as like a snooty, snobbish, arrogant guy.
Yeah.
And then we meet the general, and he's just like this alcoholic.
Yeah.
He's kind of this very worn, broken down alcoholic guy just sitting in his office monologuing about like all like the pain and death he's caused. So that was kind of like an unintentional metaphor of like, he's kind of the same person as the leader of our main group.
Yeah.
Essentially, and he's the same actor.
At the very end, you know, as he's at the he surrenders. And then after the deed is done, of course, there's the dog, which
they met earlier.
That they had met earlier, and comes through and is kind of like, I don't know. I couldn't really tell. I could tell. It was like, I think it was the first thing I thought was like, oh man, like this is just a regular guy too, you know, like even though it was presented to us from Mac's perspective, like this guy's a, I don't know, but I'm going to get him, yeah. You know?
And I don't know if this is probably not because of Fear and Desire, but having actors play multiple roles is something Kubrick would do in a few of his other movies, most specifically Dr. Strangelove, where Peter Sellers would play three different roles in the movie, one as a British Army major, another as the President of the United States, and as the titular Dr. Strangelove. Yeah, he would play three different roles, and Strangelove and the Professor would be... I mean, Strangelove and the President would be in the same scenes for most of the movie. So I don't think Fear and Desire
like inspired
that, yeah. But it's an interesting connection to like a future Kubrick film.
Yeah, I think so. I'm going to disagree with you slightly. I do think it was intentional, and I feel like when you're in that room with the general and his lackey, the lighting on their faces is very different than the rest of the film. Like, it's very high contrast, split in half. They're almost divided in half by their light. And I think it was intentional to be like, these are like parallel characters. These are the same people killing each themselves. And I just feel like it wasn't developed enough in the rest of the movie for it to work entirely. But I think that sequence was an intentional, like, these are like Freudian, because he's a big Freud guy. Yeah. Kubrick is, and I think it's like a Freudian kind of like.
Yeah, and that whole sequence where like the Lacanian. General and his second in command just in the office, and the lighting of that whole sequence, as I felt, was very well done, and it did remind me a lot of Strangelove, especially like the scenes like between Peter Sellers, his character, and like and the crazy general from that movie. Where like the crazy general in that movie goes on a lot of monologuing and rants, and it just reminded me a lot of that. So there's another connection to Strangelove.
Except in that it's a joke because he's like a crazy person talking about fluoride in the water being used as a communist plot. So maybe it was Kubrick like poking fun. That could be Kubrick poking fun at his own like character in his own movie. That could be. But yeah, the lighting in that scene's fantastic, and I feel like performances are pretty good. I feel like the lieutenant is one of the better actors.
Yeah, he was pretty good.
I think him and Mac are the two best.
Yeah, I think I want to talk a little bit about the end because we are nearing the end of the podcast. The end overall, I mean, we could talk about, I love this. I love when the raft re-shows up, you know, and it's that's like the ending, like the final ending. But before, when Mac goes in, he does his deed, and they get on the plane and get out of there. Wait, am I confusing like the very end?
What happens is Mac is on the raft. He starts shooting to like draw the soldiers away from the general's house. And then the two other soldiers run up, shoot him, get in the plane and go. Mac is on the raft, like engaging the soldiers on the shore. He gets shot, falls down, and then the raft just kind of drifts down the river, where he then encounters Sydney, who's still going insane. Sydney gets on the raft, and they float down back into friendly lines, where the two friends would find them, and then that's how the film ends.
But now, what confuses me is they got on the plane.
Yeah, they got on the plane.
They didn't leave?
No, they leave.
They fly to their own base.
Then they find Sydney and him back at the...
Yeah, Sydney and Mac, the raft just floats down the river back to the...
All the way back to the base?
Yeah, back to their base.
Okay, because you can't... That's what I got confused about. Because they go back to look. You can't really tell that they're... That's right, they did.
They talk to the general, and they're like, can we go back to look for our other men? And then...
Again, I was confused by that because of how they were switching actors, but also I was confused because you couldn't really tell that they were back on their side because they were just still in the woods. You
know what I mean? Establishing shots.
But I loved that... Yeah, but I loved that sequence where... It's Kenneth Harp and is it Fletcher who ends up living at the end? Yeah, so Fletcher. Yeah, so Fletcher's Steve Coit, where they have a sequence where their conversation at the end before the raft pulls up, I thought was a pretty good exchange and led well into the end where they were kind of, he was like, Fletcher said, I'm not made out for this way of life. And the general or the Lieutenant Corpy says, none of us are.
Yeah.
It's just a lie to like get us out here type thing. And I don't have the line perfect, but it was
it was along those lines. Yeah,
I like that exchange more than say the monologues of Mac and the general, because those just go on and on, and this one's a lot more concise and to the point.
Yeah, it kind of bummed me out how the monologues dragged on so long and kind of got boring, because at the beginning of each of them I'm like, oh word, it's like monologue time, like cool. Yeah. And then 10 minutes later I'm like, this should be over now.
Yeah. It's an hour long movie and like 30 minutes of it are internal monologues. Yeah. But I mean, Paths of Glory has a very long monologue at the end that's kind of similar to the one that the lieutenant gives at the end of this one, but like, you know, he pushes
it, elevates 100%. I could see that.
Yeah, it's I think we've kind of been kicking this movie while it's down a little bit for a while.
100%. Like,
but I don't know.
So did Kubrick.
Yeah, I don't think we're wrong for doing it, but yeah. I am of the opinion that if you are interested in movies, interested especially in making movies, you should 100% watch this and like take notes. What do you guys, how do you guys feel about
that? Oh, I totally agree.
Oh yeah, I was going to say the same thing, that if you're like interested in making films, I would recommend watching this. Also because it also kind of has a lesson of like, hey, even one of the most acclaimed directors of all time, even their first project isn't really... Even his first project wasn't a great one. So
wasn't perfect.
If you're just getting started and you make a film and it doesn't turn out great, you still have room to improve, because Kubrick made a film that wasn't that good, and then he would go on to become one of the most acclaimed directors of all time. So there's definitely a lesson in that.
That's but, right.
Yeah, like don't give up if like one project you make isn't that good.
Yeah, learn from your mistakes. Know what you did right. Know what you did wrong. And, you know, learn and be open. I mean, there's...
Take criticism, like, and don't just shun it away. Like, you don't have a big ego. I mean, it's very easy to do that, but...
And Kubrick would try and shun it away. He would, like... Yeah. He destroyed most of the copies of this film. The only reason it exists is because the company at Kodiak, which did the film, had a copy of it in their archive. And then got bootlegged, and that... How it got online.
Yeah, the good version, which is, I watched a good one, they found a print in Peru. Like, an original theatrical print from some sort of festival
dope.
Because they store old film prints in salt mines.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's something with the nitrate. It's like silver nitrate or something the film's made out of. Okay. And the salt absorbs moisture, so they don't take it on. But they found one, and make sure you watch it in black and white the way it was shot.
Yeah, I messed up on that. But I don't think it was the end of the world. There was only a few moments, because I did watch it in color. I watched it on Amazon Prime, and it was just in there on color. And I mean, I'm watching it, and I'm like, well, obviously, because it's from then. And I kind of wish I did watch it in black and white. But it wasn't the worst. The only weird part was when his ears were like the same... Sydney Paul Mazursky's ears were like the same color as the background.
Oh, they were.
It was really funny. Yeah. Yeah. And of course that's just all post-production stuff. I have to mention, you know, that Paul Mazursky, who played Private Sydney, went on to be an Academy Award nominated screenwriter / director. He directed Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, as well as An Unmarried Woman, which are classics from what I've heard, and for to be nominated in multiple categories is amazing.
Yeah,
and
quite a few of the people in this movie would go on to have like big careers after, besides Kubrick.
That's right. And so it was Sackler who helped Howard Sackler who helped him write the film. This was Kubrick's childhood friend, and he is best known for writing the play The Great White Hope, and winning a
he won a Pulitzer Prize and
Pulitzer
Tony
Prize
Award for
thank
that.
You thank you. I was like, where'd it go? Yes, he was well acclaimed for his work, and then also those two and the actor, it was Frank Silvera, who went on to write the Killer's Kiss, right?
Yeah, like, the Killer's Kiss?
Yeah, yes. That'd be Kubrick's second film after this. Mm-hmm.
Which he needed a job on a promotional short called The Sea Bearer to be able to fund Killer's Kiss, because Fear and Desire was not enough to fund Killer's Kiss.
It just made its budget back. Yeah. But hey, it made its budget back. So that's looks like we're out of time.
I'd say we're just about out of time here. So I would like to thank you all very much for coming and hanging out with us on the radio cast. For everyone here at ECAT, have yourself a wonderful rest of your week, rest of your evening, and yeah, take it easy, y'all.